The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes before a packed audience at Brookings's Falk Auditorium, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 11th, 2018. 1 year ago this week, James Comey was fired as FBI director. In the year that's followed, the President of the United States has been attacking federal law enforcement. The Congress of the United States has been outing law enforcement and intelligence sources. A sharp partisan divide has opened up in attitudes toward law enforcement and toward the FBI in particular. And even as a counterintelligence and criminal investigation continues involving the president threatens to remove senior law enforcement officials and the special counsel. We're going to talk about it all. We're going to talk about the culture of the Bureau in politically extreme moments. We're going to talk about forest fires. We're going to talk about what happens when the political system goes to war against the Bureau. And we're going to talk about Jim's book. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 310, Jim Comey on a Higher Loyalty. Jim, welcome back to Brookings.
Great to be back here. Thank you for having me.
So the last time you were here was a little bit different context.
Yes, it was the quiet, boring days of encryption.
Right. Yeah. We have a blue background, but I was expecting to make a joke about it if you were wearing a blue jacket, but
I'm an earth tone author now.
I want to start by talking about the culture of the Bureau, and specifically a question of who speaks for the Bureau in moments when the Bureau is under political attack. You write in the book about the need to keep the Bureau apolitical, and it is hard to be apolitical when you are the subject of attacks that are in their nature political. And I wonder what the right way for the Bureau to handle sustained political attack, either from the legislative or from the executive branch, looks like.
Yeah, I don't know what the right answer is, because I don't think the Bureau's ever encountered a situation like this. It's been criticized aggressively from other branches of government, especially the legislative branch. It's never been simultaneously criticized by the leader of the executive branch and by outsiders, including the legislative branch. When just the legislature's coming after the Bureau, you can expect the leadership chain up to the President of the United States to speak up and speak out about that institution. So I don't think we've ever faced a situation like this where the fire is coming from all sides. So I don't think there's an easy answer. And I don't envy Chris Wray's challenge now. He's a person of integrity and principle, but I can't see from the outside the struggles he must be going through in figuring out how to speak for the organization. So that's a long way of saying I don't know. I know what I'd like to see. I'd like to see the Attorney General speak for the FBI. I'd like to see the director be free because he has the support of the Attorney General and the President to speak for the FBI. But I could imagine that being very complicated right now for the director.
So it's also complicated for you, I assume, right? You're the former director. To the extent that somebody is out there speaking for the FBI, it is you. And as I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know, there is a lot of people who think you're being too forward. Yeah. And so on the one hand, you have Chris Wray, who a lot of people in the Bureau feel kind of abandoned by the absence of leadership speaking out. On the other hand, you have you speaking quite actively and aggressively, and that makes people uncomfortable too.
Yeah, I get the question, but I hope folks who ask that would take a longer, wider view and realize actually we all have an obligation to speak for the institutions of justice because they're what we have in common. They're what serves as the foundation for our country, for the rule of law, for the pursuit of truth. And so everybody should care deeply about it and speak about it. And if people are refusing to do so for reasons that I'm sure we can talk about, so what? Those who are capable of speaking should speak. And I don't think I'm the only person speaking for the Bureau, but I know the Bureau well, and I'm a private citizen. I wish I weren't, but I am a private citizen. And so shame on me if I didn't speak. One of the institutions that I thought both parties in this country understood was critical to our democracy is under attack. And if the people, especially in the Republican Party, aren't going to speak for it, all of us who know well enough to make informed comments about it ought to be speaking about it. And so I don't think I have any choice but to speak for the Bureau.
So what about the Bureau itself institutionally? I can see a couple of arguments. One is, look, when you've got both the White House and the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, you know, engaged in political attacks on the Bureau, you have to defend it institutionally. And that may mean you have to, you know, say things that will appear to politicize, you know, to put the Bureau in a political context. I can also see the argument that the right way to handle it is simply to put your head down institutionally, do your work, and not defend yourself. I find that thoroughly objectionable, and I can't quite put my finger on why. And I'm interested, do you think the Bureau should be institutionally defending itself?
Yes, but again, it's hard for me to judge the choices the director's making from the outside, because I could imagine him concluding that it's more important for the Bureau to have stable leadership right now than that he get fired for speaking out on behalf of the institution. And so, believe me, having been in that job and seen all kinds of people with passionate, overly confident views of the decisions I was making, I don't want to do that to the current director because I can't see how he's thinking about it. But look, I think the institution should try and find every way possible to explain itself and defend itself, because that's a question of effectiveness. Where the Bureau works is when agents knock on a door and tell someone who's been the victim of a vicious sexual assault by a gang, we will protect you, you can trust us. Or when they stand up in a courtroom and say, we found this in the left-hand desk drawer of this corporate CFO, and here are my initials when I seized it, and you should believe me, people of the jury. If they're not believed at the doorstep and in the courtroom, they're ineffective, and they can't do the good that I hope we all understand they do for this country. I mean, it's a group of human beings, of course they're flawed, but in the overwhelming main, they're doing things we need done. And we tend to take a Washington-centric view of it, I get that, and focus on a lot of the conflict narrative on Pennsylvania Avenue. But the real danger is that its credibility, its effectiveness at those doors and in those courtrooms is being diminished, and we will all be deeply sorry as that happens.
So there was this one moment, and it got lost after the firing, where you really faced a question about how actively in public to talk about what the Bureau did and didn't do in the current political environment. And it was when the president tweeted that his predecessor had had his wires tapped, and you were then asked in an open congressional hearing whether there was any evidence, you know, what the truth of that was. So I'm interested, you're retroactive on that. That's a moment where the Bureau was being accused of, you know, frank impropriety or illegality, and you're the head of the Bureau. Is that, you know, what, for those who don't remember, what you said, as I recall, was that we have no evidence to support the president's tweets. Are you satisfied in retrospect that that was the appropriate way to for the sitting FBI director to defend the institution?
I don't know. I think there's a good argument to be made. I should have been more aggressive earlier. And had I known I was going to be fired, I would have been much more aggressive earlier. But look, the challenge I faced is I intended to serve for another 6 years. I don't want to be at war with a president and the White House. I'm trying to build a relationship with a new leadership team at the Department of Justice. And so I'm trying to calibrate. But I woke up that morning, that was back when I followed the president on Twitter, and I saw that, and my reaction was, that is simply outrageous. The president of the United States, without any factual basis, has just accused the Department of Justice and the FBI of serious federal felonies, right? That is outrageous. And maybe in retrospect, I should have spoken out that day. I thought the Department of Justice leadership should have spoken out right away. And I pushed them very hard, because I knew testimony was coming up, to authorize me to say that at that hearing, and they granted me that permission. But in retrospect, again, it's hard, because I know I got fired a year ago, but maybe I should have spoken out more aggressively. Maybe there's an argument to be made that it would have, by this argument, which is why I'm pausing like this, it would have chilled the president's attacks on the institutions of justice. But long way of saying maybe, but I don't know.
Uh-huh. All right, so there are three models I want to talk about of reaction to political attacks on the Bureau. One is the Justice Department leadership, which has done one thing. One is Chuck Rosenberg, who was the head of the DEA, who did another thing. And the other is Devin Nunes, who responded to the events that we just discussed by launching a series of investigations designed to prove that the president's tweet was true. Let's start with the Justice Department leadership. Rod Rosenstein said the other day that the Justice Department will not be extorted. If you could write the script for Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions to talk about the current situation, bearing in mind that they would prefer not to be fired and that in Rosenstein's case has an obligation to protect the special counsel's investigation, how should they be talking?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I would hope everybody would first approach it not afraid to lose their job. That part of, I think, what allows people to convince themselves they ought to make these compromises that allow the president to undermine and Congress to undermine the rule of law is this notion that I need to be here, and so I need to be calibrated. And I think members of Congress who know better, who know these attacks on the institution of justice are wrong, are telling themselves, well, I don't want to upset the base because then I might lose my renomination and I need to be in Congress to serve the greater good. I think everybody needs to realize you're kidding yourself by telling yourself those stories. And so you need to realize what's at stake a little more keenly and take more risks with your job first. Second, Rod Rosenstein is in a uniquely difficult position. I think he's conducted himself honorably since my firing, and I don't know whether it's an atonement or what it is, but whatever the reason is, he has worked very hard to protect the prerogatives of the special counsel and the department more broadly, and so I think he is speaking in a good way now. It would be better if the Attorney General were giving him institutional, thoughtful top cover by giving speeches about the importance of the rule of law and about even-handed law enforcement and about the Department of Justice being in the executive branch, but never being entirely of the executive branch, and all those principles that Republicans, I think, and Democrats all have agreed with for generations. So I think the Deputy Attorney General is doing fine. I'd like to see him getting more top cover from the Attorney General.
All right, so Chuck Rosenberg strikes me here as the unique exception at the senior levels of the Justice Department. After your firing, and when the president said in a public speech that people should be a little bit less careful, cops should be a little bit less careful with detainees' heads when they put them into cars, he wrote a letter to the DEA staff saying that that didn't reflect our values as law enforcement officers. I assume when he did that, he must have expected that that wouldn't go over well. He was not fired and left shortly thereafter. What kind of, is that the sort of thing that you're talking about? Or is that the sort of thing that, you know, you look at it and you say, well, that's great for somebody who kind of means to leave anyway, but is, you know, would essentially be a sort of self-imposed Saturday night massacre if everybody behaved that way.
Yeah, I think it is a model, because we're all destined to leave these jobs and this earth anyway. And so convincing yourself, telling yourself this story about my value and how I have to stay is a fool's bargain, in my view. Chuck was acting like someone who was prepared, because he wanted to speak about principle, to be fired for a principle. And the question I keep asking and urging, especially Republicans today, to ask themselves is the grandchildren question. What are you going to tell your grandchildren? You did what today? And why? And what will the story be that you'll tell your grandchildren? Well, there were important tax cuts on the table, there were important policy issues, and so I did the following. I don't think you can explain that trade to your grandchildren, even if it means the loss of your job. I think the honorable thing to do is remember what the institutions stand for and stand for that. And if you get fired because of that, think of the story you'll be able to tell your grandchildren and inspire them someday. And if you shame yourself by making trades, telling yourself some story about your value to the nation and making trades on those principles, I don't know what you're going to tell your grandchildren.
So what's Devin Nunes going to be able to tell his grandchildren? I mean, it's a serious question, because he's actually gone, you know, he's not merely making trades, right? He is affirmatively acting in a fashion that some of us judged, you know, Edward Snowden very harshly for behaving in a fashion that puts at risk intelligence sources and methods when being told, and sources individually, when being told so by the senior levels of the Justice Department. And for the House Intelligence Committee chairman to be doing this strikes me as a bit of a different thing than the kind of routine trades that you're describing because you think your role is important. So how do you assess, what do you think is going on there, and how should we understand it?
I can't understand. I'm sure there's some story he tells himself that tries to make sense of it all, but I can't explain it. And with the grandchildren, he'll probably tell his grandchildren, look, I got to jump in this Uber and meet somebody. I don't know what the story would be. And this is my hope for the Republicans as a whole, that they realize that only a fool would trade the institutions and the values that actually unite us for the policy gains they think they're getting from a president who is eroding and attacking those values that unite us. I don't know what they're telling themselves.
Okay, so on the specific issue that Nunes has precipitated that's become public this week, I am interested in what, so there's two elements. One is the safety of the particular source in question. But the second is what the message that it sends to people who would cooperate with U.S. intelligence or law enforcement in general when the House Intelligence Committee is behaving in a fashion that says the intelligence community cannot protect you because we will force identifying information out. I am interested in your thoughts on how extreme a deviance that is. So like in the history of intelligence oversight that you've been a part of, that you've interacted with these committees, have you ever seen anything like that?
No. And the reason is because I thought everyone understood that the absolute core of the intelligence community, including the FBI, is its human sources. That's really all the FBI is. That's really all the CIA is. People who tell us things that we can use to protect the country and to protect innocent people in exchange for a promise that we will make sure you are protected. That is the golden core of those organizations, and I thought everybody understood that. And to play with that, to jeopardize that, you might again tell yourself a story, it's one case, risks the death of the thing that is at the core of our ability to protect this country. I'm not given to overstatement. You cannot overstate the danger in that kind of behavior to the security of the United States.
I want to talk about the culture of the Bureau. One of the really interesting features of the book that I think has actually gotten very little discussion in everybody's interest in Hillary Clinton's emails and your interactions with Donald Trump are, A, your descriptions of the culture of the FBI, but also your descriptions of your efforts to change those that culture in some respects. And so I'm like your thoughts, first of all, about what about the FBI culture when you came in as director you looked at and said, this is the timeless aspect that we need to preserve and build on? And what are the aspects that you looked at and you said, this is nuts and it's destructive and we should try to move in a different direction?
Yeah, it's a great question. The part that impressed me and should give all of us comfort in these difficult times, which I see as the ballast of this country, is also held in common by the military services and the rest of the intelligence community, and that is this, I was going to say fanatical, I don't mean that way, but passionate commitment to the rule of law and distaste for everything political. And that is a great feature of the FBI and a great feature, I believe, of the military services and the intelligence community and should give us all comfort. It's hard to screw that up. I mean, the challenge of being a leader trying to change culture, which I'll get to in a second, is it's really hard to change human culture. And no president serves long enough to screw up that essential element of the Bureau's culture and the rest of those agencies I mentioned. And so that's great news. The challenges of the Bureau is many. It reflects the 50 years of J. Edgar Hoover. There's interesting academic research about whether it's even possible to fundamentally change culture after an organization has lived through the life of its founder, which is what the FBI did for its first 50 years or so. And so there are positive aspects of that, which I just talked about, rule of law and distaste for all things political. But on the other side is it's very hierarchical, director-centric, and it's what a management consultant would call fear-based. That is, there's a tremendous concern about losing face in front of others, being embarrassed in front of others. And so that's a recipe when you're the director for a terrifying state of affairs. You're at the top of this steep pyramid, and it's very steep by virtue of its hierarchical culture, and everybody's afraid down that steep slope of being embarrassed. So how do you get the truth up the hill to yourself? That's a big challenge.
So early in your directorship, you and I had lunch in the FBI cafeteria. You insisted that we go to the FBI cafeteria. And it was a very big deal when you walked into the room.
Because I was with you. Yeah, exactly. Look, it's Ben Wittes.
So, one of the great things about this, you're putting out the book now, is you finally get to reclaim your independent identity.
Friend of Ben.
It was, you know, a very big deal that the director had just walked into the cafeteria, and you stood in back of the one person in the entire place who hadn't noticed that you'd walked in, who was some kind of young counterterrorism analyst in the sandwich line, and she was real flustered when she turned around. And the last time we had lunch in the Bureau cafeteria, which was March 27th of last year, it was not a big deal when you walked into the cafeteria. I mean, it was a little bit like John Allen walking into the cafeteria at Brookings. People noticed, people stopped to say hi, but it wasn't like everything stopped and every head turned. I was interested that you wrote about this in the book, that this was like a part of an active sort of campaign to humanize the directorship and kind of break down those hierarchies a little bit. Shirt color has something to do with it. I mean, what are the elements of this, and to what extent was it successful?
Yeah. You can't change human culture with training, because culture, in my experience, is best defined as the way things are really done around here, no matter what they tell you in training. And so it's an unspoken set of assumptions, unspoken set of understandings about relationships and hierarchy. And so you can only change it by modeling it. And then you can reinforce that by talking about it. But this was part of a lot of things I did to try and model that I need the pyramid to, I'm not fool enough to think I can flatten it, but the slope to become much more gradual, so I more often hear the truth about myself, but also about other important things. And so I did that in lots of ways, some silly, some really important. Going to the cafeteria every day was really important to me. The first time I did it, my assistant then wasn't the woman who's there now, Althea James. It was a long-serving assistant, had been there through multiple directors, and she was not used to that. And I walked past at noon, and she said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to go get a sandwich." And she said, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Because I'm hungry." And she said, "Well, where are you going to get it?" And I said, "I'm going to the cafeteria." And she said, "What if people try to talk to you?" And I'm not picking on her. She was just used to a different frame. And I said, "I hope they talk to me. They're my people." And so I would go every day. I would never wear my jacket. I went once, I think, without a tie, and it caused a scandal, so I put the tie back on. But I went, and I always walked, even if I was feeling beat down, I always tried to stand up straight, walk with a smile on my face, greet everyone, without regard to rank, and then stand in line and never cut the line. And then I would interview people in the line. So it was about symbolism, but I also learned a lot from those conversations in the line. And I recount in the book my favorite, and no spoiler here, but I want to tell you. I'm standing there one day when Ben wasn't there, and a guy behind me, I turn and say, as I typically did, "So where do you work?" And he said, "I work in IT, I work on servers," and I start asking follow-ups, and he works fixing our infrastructure, and he loves it because he gets more experience than he could in the private sector. He's been here 3 years. Then there's an awkward pause, and he says, "How about yourself?" True story. And so I said, "I've been there over a year at this point." I said, "I'm the director." And he says, "Director of..." And I said, "Dude, I'm the director of the FBI. You work for me." And he goes, "Oh my God, you look so different online." So I went home and told my wife that story. She said, "That should happen every day, every day." But it was an important symbolic thing, and I also learned. And I could get the temperature of the FBI. And then it was an opportunity to communicate. Because look, the FBI, you know this now, plays a lot of its games on national television and gets criticized. And so my walking and literally the carriage of my shoulders could communicate to hundreds of people, "We're going to be okay. Yeah, it's a nightmare, but we're going to be okay." Just by the way I carried myself. And so every day I was in Washington, even if I didn't have the time, I went up there to get the sandwich and waited in the line. And it became the panini line, which is a whole nother nightmare. And always paid. One day I walked away and the cashier said to the next person, "I can't believe he pays." And I came back and said, "Wait, I could get it for free." I said, "No, you couldn't." But that's about, and I did lots of other things to try to demonstrate. I told senior FBI executives, "Do not come dressed up to meet with me. Right? You don't wear outer garments when you come to me, because if you're dressed like you're in church, you'll act like you're in church." I asked them to tell me at Halloween their favorite Halloween candy when they were a kid. I asked them, one of my very first meetings, I went around the room and said, "I want every one of you," so 30 most senior people in the FBI, "I want every one of you to say something about yourself that will surprise the rest of the people in this room, and please let it not affect your security clearance." And and they were like, "What?" And then it started to loosen up, and we learned that one very senior stern person is addicted to Disney and goes to Disney World multiple times a day. And then someone else then confessed on his private life he drives a Volkswagen Beetle, which was shocking. But what I was trying to do was flatten it so people would talk to me.
So a lot of those stories convey to an audience of normal people that this is a, you know, what the hell were your predecessors doing, right? If this was the culture, that these were radical steps. You know, you had some pretty distinguished predecessors, including Bob Mueller. How did this culture manage to persist over this length of time?
Because culture is so hard to change. I mean, Hoover set the FBI's culture, and directors since have been trying to change aspects of it. Bob Mueller transformed the FBI in a way that I'm still in awe of and I don't think I could have done. And he focused on what he had to focus on. Now, in doing that, he wore a white shirt every day, not most days, every day. And he wore two ties, a blue one and a red one. Then he'd wear the blue one, then he'd wear the red one. And it was part of his effort. And I asked him one time, "So, Bob, do you have other clothes? And he said, I did it on purpose as a bridge to the Hoover agents. He said, I was trying to drive so much change into this organization, to literally change the detective culture that Hoover birthed, and I couldn't afford at the margins to alienate them with the smaller things. The bureau he gave me was a gift because it had been transformed in all those ways, and so I could focus on things that he hadn't had the time or in his view, which makes sense to me, the opportunity given where he was. So I could focus on diversity and leadership and communication and all of the things that the private sector has been focusing on for a generation or more and try and bring it to the bureau because of what he gave me.
So what does it do? You take a culture that is that buttoned up, that is in which the steps that you're describing are kind of radical and themselves a little bit traumatic. And then you have the president tweeting about individuals in that culture. What does that do to just the sort of day-to-day morale and atmosphere of being in an agency like that?
It hurts and demoralizes, at least in the short term. And part of it is the turbulence, despite what you've been told. I had a fairly close relationship with the workforce. And so you lose a leader that you feel connected to. And then you are leaders that you've heard great things about. They may not know Jim Baker the way they know me, but they've heard about him and know the kind of person he is by reputation. And they see the president hitting someone like that or hitting other executives. It demoralizes them. And I really think it worries them most at those margins that I talked about, the knocking on the door, the standing up in front of a jury, because that's all about the effectiveness of the organization. Now, in the long run, they'll recover from it. But what I worry about every day, and I think all of us without regard to political party should worry about, is the damage that's being done to the country and to our communities by the pain and distrust that's being built at the margins.
What gauges do you have of current morale? I mean, I'm going to ask you about the forthcoming climate survey in a moment, but I mean, you're still in touch with people, you still hear from people. What do you hear about what the atmosphere there is right now?
I don't know that I have a reliable read, which is why I'm not going to FOIA, I know you will, the climate survey.
Already done.
Okay. Look, that's a really important tool, and I drove it into every conversation in the FBI about leadership and development, because it's an anonymous survey where around 80% of the Bureau's employees participate, and it takes them a long time to fill out because it gathers data from a rich set of vectors. So that would be the most reliable. My sense is, and it could be a selection bias here, is that they feel under siege, that they believe they'll be okay in the long run, but they're very worried. And they're most hurt when neighbors and friends and relatives are asking them, so what's going on? And then asking questions that embedded in which is the assumption that the Bureau is politicized. And that drives them around the bend, because the Bureau is not politicized. That's just a lie. It's being politically attacked, that's for sure. But the culture of that place is the way it's been for decades. It hates politicians. And we'll investigate them fairly, I should add. But it hates political weasels. It hates political, anything political. That's an epithet in the FBI. He's political or she's political is one of the worst things you can say about somebody in that organization. So I think they have faith in the long run, but they're feeling pain now.
When you see the climate survey, when we finally get it, what do you expect it to reflect? What are the metrics that you're going to look at as evocative of the current atmosphere?
There's a measure about pride in the organization and its mission. There's a measure about confidence in senior leadership, more broadly than just the director. There is measures about the regard with which we believe we're held by the people we interact with in the course of our job. Those sorts of things would be the most important to me. But I used to get not just the readout, but I would get a book of everything said about me or to me in the comments. And it was hundreds of pages long, and you could only read that 20 pages at a time, because even though you're doing largely well, there's some aunts and uncles in every family who have strong feelings. But that, so I would want to look at the data And then I would want to spend, you won't get this, I don't think, the comments. If I were the director, I'd want to spend, it would take weeks, and I used to take it, weeks living in those comments, reading them and getting a feel for how people are doing.
I want to talk about forest fires. You use the metaphor of a forest fire in the book to describe the current president. And so start us by explaining how you use the metaphor, and then I'm going to ask you to reflect upon some of the implications of the metaphor.
Yeah. I chose that metaphor to reflect two different reactions I have to this president. One, a strong sense that he's going to do and is doing great damage to the norms that unite us, a commitment to the rule of law, equal protection of the laws, freedom of expression, and the truth, most of all, central American values. And so a forest fire does great damage. But I chose forest fire because I believe that in the wake of a forest fire, incredible things grow that didn't have the space or the water or the light to grow before, and it's an opportunity. And I think Watergate was a forest fire for this country, and some incredible things grew, including a rebalancing of power among the three branches of government after Watergate. And so because I'm an optimistic person, and I really do believe this about America, I think the forest fire captures the danger and the opportunity and the optimism that I feel.
All right.
So you want to poke at that?
Well, I want to explore it. I think it's
You're going to go with meteor hitting the Earth?
There's no basis for optimism about the giant meteor of death. The forest fire presents two opportunities, right? So one is that it destroys the canopy so that all kinds of things can grow. And the second is that it fertilizes, that you know, the carbon. And so I'm interested in your sense of what you're looking to be allowed to grow that we should be optimistic about. What are the things that you look at as the sort of seedlings of new growth, or are they not yet visible because we're still in the middle of the forest fire?
Yeah. I see some growth already, and the growth that I see is an energy in the media. I was going to say the other branches of government, I would distinguish them. I see tremendous energy in the judiciary. I was actually worried, as I know you were and Jack Goldsmith was, about a freakout in the judiciary. I see this, maybe I'm kidding myself, but a shoot coming up in Congress, at least some parts of it regaining its role in our constitutional system. I see tremendous energy in young people. And I don't have good data on this, but I have a strong sense that other parts of civil society are feeling a compulsion to talk about respect and prejudice and truth-telling. And I would include parents and teachers in that. That was not happening 3 years ago or 2 years ago. And so I see all those as signs of the growth that will come. To me, the most important is, I think, there's a sleeping giant in this country, which is our common commitment to values. Talk about how hard culture is to change. We've been the same for a long time. Read de Tocqueville and say, oh, we really were that way. We are that way. And what unites us is a commitment to those things I talk about. And one of my favorite pieces of literature is Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, where he's writing to that sleeping giant. Right, the moderates who are sitting on the sidelines, and he's saying, you can't sit on the sidelines. We cannot wait. I feel the same way about today, and I could be convincing myself of this, but I feel the giant stirring. That is not the crazies at the wings of our political spectrum, but all the people in the middle who are so busy raising families and working, but who embody those values and care deeply about them. I have a sense that that giant is starting to awaken. And one of the things I'm trying to do is participate in a conversation to wake the giant.
So I'm going to ask you about a few of those specific seedlings that you mentioned, but I want to ask you, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about what you're trying to do. You know, are you trying to make a lot of money with a book? Are you trying to talk about the president's appearance? And, you know, are you trying to, you know, exculpate yourself for every decision that anyone's made that you've disagreed with.
Yes.
What's the strategic objective? You know, like what's, you know, you've gone from being silent to being omnipresent. What are you trying to get
that
done?
That will go away soon. what I'm trying to get done is none of those first three things. I think if you read the book, you'll see that one of the many lessons I've learned from my wife is that in the wake of something bad happening, we have an obligation to try and make good follow it, not to make it worth it, but because that's what it means to go on living and to find meaning in your life. And she and I talked about this a lot. And the reason I wrote this book and the reason I'm talking about it is I think the good I can foster in a small way is raising the conversation above the things we fight with each other about and too quickly hate each other about, guns, taxes, immigration, to that which we have in common, which is that core set of values. Because without this, we are nothing. As a country, we're just a set of values. And awakening in part that sleeping giant to the danger to those values right now, and hopefully as part of that, shaming Republicans by asking them to think about the grandchildren conversation and to reframe. I think we need a moment of inflection. We need clarity around what we stand for. And I can't do that, but I can be a small part of the voices that are trying to raise the conversation up to this. And I think, and I was misunderstood because I probably misspoke a little bit when I told George Stephanopoulos, I kind of hoped the president was not impeached and convicted. And what I meant by that was not that the process laid out in our Constitution shouldn't be followed if appropriate. What I meant was, in a way, that would deprive, let us all off the hook. And in the course of that, drive a dysfunction deep into the fabric of this country that'd be hard to unstick. And what I mean by off the hook is, we have an obligation as Americans to stand up and say, you know what, I may disagree with you about this or that, but we have this thing in common. And if we lose that, we've lost what is essentially this country, and to vote that. And I would expect the next presidential election to be an inflection point. And then we'll get back to the vicious fights about all the things at the lower level, but that we have to focus on the higher level. And I think a big part of that is waking the giant.
So you mentioned a few specific seedling institutions that you're whose performance you evaluate differently. I want to talk about two in particular. The first is the press, where you're, on the one hand, you have never been a friend of leaks of classified material to the press, and you've been pretty fierce on the subject. On another hand, you just said, look, you're kind of impressed with the way the press has conducted itself over the last year and a half and in this environment. And so I'm interested in what aspect of what the press is doing, has done, do you look at and say, hey, this is actually the way the democratic process is supposed to work. This is the function that one would pray for in a press in a time of stress.
Yeah. They're resisting the numbness that is a danger to all of us. And I've said this, but I'll repeat it. I wake up in the morning some mornings and the President of the United States has tweeted that I should be in jail. And my reaction is, there he goes. Because I know there's nothing to that. He's just making stuff up. But then I catch myself and say, wait a minute, what are you becoming numb to? The President of the United States just said a private citizen should be in jail. Close your eyes, Republicans, and imagine Barack Obama doing that, or the next Democratic president do that. That is a disturbing threat to a norm at this level that is at the heart of this country. And so there's a danger, though, I'll become numb to it. You all become numb to it. The truth is the central touchstone of the United States of America. We've always measured our politicians by their tether to that truth. And they all lie and they all weasel, and we hold them accountable, we measure them, and they try to explain how what they said wasn't a lie. There's a danger now that the touchstone is going to melt like a sandcastle at the beach because there's so much lying that we all become numb to it. Ah, there he goes. He just lied again. What the press has done is not allow themselves to become numb to it. There's been some Trump freakout on that side, but they are continuing to allow all of us, if we can rouse ourselves, to not be numb by constantly fact-checking and calling it out. It's been imperfect. But I think that's great. And I don't think you need to be disclosing classified information to do that. I think the freak out that was going on at the beginning of this administration with people, I'm not going to confirm the leaks, but there was some leaking of material that was deeply concerning and that affects other important norms. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about it is exercising its role imperfectly and messily to remind all of us of the touchstones, especially that truth. And I've been very impressed with it.
What about Congress?
Not so much.
All right, so I want to talk about Congress in a little bit of a more granular way. On the one hand, you have what the House Intelligence Committee has done. You have the fact that the Speaker of the House has backed the House Intelligence Committee on repeated occasions. You have document requests, including from the Senate, that are pretty outrageous from the Judiciary Committee. On the other hand, the Congress imposed sanctions on Russia over the president's objection. The Senate Intelligence Committee seems to be conducting a fairly serious and bipartisan investigation in the Russia space.
Yep.
And if the president has not yet fired Robert Mueller, one reason does seem to be that certain Republican senators have signaled that that would not be acceptable. So when you look in the aggregate at congressional performance, do you see fundamentally the abdication, or do you see shoots that are potentially things to build on after the forest fire? How do you evaluate it as an institution?
I see shoots of growth, and I think you summarized them. I see an abdication, in fact, an affirmative enablement of the attack on the rule of law coming from some quarters that you mentioned. But I do see, in fits and starts, Democrats and Republicans asserting, realizing that they're a third branch of the government and acting that way. And that's what early signs that we could easily lose, but early signs is going to be a growth akin to a rebalancing that happened after the last great forest fire. So I see that. And I agree with what you said about Senators Burr and Warner and their committee. I think they've been conducting a credible investigation. And so I would say I don't see it as the response as encouraging, the growth as high as in the media, but I see growth.
You have expressed anger in the last year very rarely. There is one time, however, that I thought was very striking, and I want to ask you about it. In your SSCI testimony in, I guess, June of last year, you said with a lot of emotion that you were sorry that you had not had a chance to say goodbye. And it comes up again in the book, and there's a quite horrible set of stories in the book about the day that the firing happened and some of the impacts on some individuals. Who were you thinking about? What's the group of people that you were thinking about that you did not have a chance to say goodbye to, and that under other circumstances your departure would have been, you would have wanted to say things to?
The people you've never heard of, the so-called ordinary people of the Bureau. The best thing about the FBI is the people, and their committed to a mission. They believe in the moral content of the work. They're funny and irreverent and kind. And I really became close to them. And I was offended that they were being lied about the organization being in tatters and all this nonsense. And I really was pained that I was banned from the property. My stuff was boxed up like I had died and was brought to my house by a group of custodial employees, all of whom I knew. And so they stayed in my driveway. We took pictures. But that I had to do that in the driveway was really offensive to me. And I think of people like on the seventh floor of the FBI. The FBI is this, if you've been inside the building, it's a vertigo-inducing and incredibly depressing building. But I used to just go around and find doors that I'd never been in before and knock on the door and go in. And there was one room that I'd walk past a few times to go get lunch that you and I had walked past. And I think it just said special file room. And I thought, I wonder what the special files are. And so I knocked one day. And It turns out it was like the Wizard of Oz. You knock, and actually, they don't look through the door. There's a window. And so a little piece of cardboard goes up, and I see a set of eyes, and it comes down, and they open the door. And it's these, I think, four ladies, mostly, so about my age, late 50s. I think they were all African-American. And they were, their job was to keep certain sensitive files that the leadership needed to see before they were sent back to storage. And no one had ever come to visit them. And I walked in, and they were all embarrassed because they had pictures of me all over the place. And I said, you knew I was coming. And they said, we had no idea you were coming. And so I got to know these people, and I would visit them. I'd walk past, knock, say, I'm just checking on the special files. And but that story is one, but there were dozens of those. And that's what makes life and work fun, at least brings me joy. And not to have the chance to walk around and shake their hands, to hug them, that kind of stuff, was really brutal. And I'm sure the president didn't give it a thought, because maybe he doesn't give those kind of people a thought, but to me it was pain. And that was, it's funny you said that, that was the only part of my testimony that I struggled over. I mean, I actually almost had trouble getting through it because of those kind of people. So that is, to my mind, forget about the finding out on television, all that business, the cruelty of not allowing the director of the FBI, who didn't steal a thing, right, not being able to come back and get his family pictures and all of his things, and to say goodbye to all those people was uncalled for.
We will take your questions.
Thank you. Director retired out of Division 5 in 2005. So after 9/11, pertains to the IC and the Bureau specifically, we all had to surge to Division 13, to CT Division.
Yeah.
And then everybody, Division 6, Division 5, started to reconstitute in the wake of 9/11 after we get back on our feet. Was the counterintelligence community that you had to turn to, both with the Clinton investigation and the Russian intel investigation, was the counterintelligence community you had to turn to up to the task after 17 years, 15 years, 16 years after 9/11? Or had CT, the bow wake of CT, so overwhelmed the U.S. counterintelligence capability that you found it to be perhaps lacking?
Yeah. So you're definitely right. There was a bow wave, and you know, that huge sucking sound was everybody being moved to CT right after 9/11. By the time I became director, there had been a significant rebalancing. And to do those two, we drew on both headquarters and WFO people. At least in my interaction with them, we had an all-star group. And so I never had any indication of that.
One of the initiatives you talk about trying to strengthen as director of the FBI was a diversification of the workforce, which strikes me as both very important and commendable. I'm curious what you think the current political environment, the impact that will have on that particular effort.
Yeah, I'm worried. I have some anecdotal reason for optimism because we had turned a corner. We had a major agent class. Our mission was, the whole FBI's mission, and we gave this mission to all the field offices, was get out there and show people who don't think about working here what an amazing place this is to work. You should take a huge cut in pay and absorb tremendous stress and come work for the FBI. But I tell you, people want to make a difference. And so talented lawyers, engineers, MBAs of color and women were turning to us. We had a class at Quantico before I left. It was 38% non-white. Incredible talent was coming in. And so my worry was, especially given some of the signals at the top level of our government, would that change? I snuck into an FBI intramural basketball game held at the Verizon Center. I've still not been to headquarters, but I went because I knew some of the people playing. And after the game, I talked to them. And one was an African-American agent who had come in, he said, because of me. And he said, I want you to know something. It's continuing. He said, enough talented people came in those 4 years that we're attracting people after us. I hope so. But it's worth worrying about. I was going to focus on it for 10 years because my worry was, I got no problem with white people. We had plenty of talented white people, but we weren't attracting enough great people of similar caliber from all different other groups. And I figured 10 years of attention, we will create a momentum that's irreversible. Everybody will want to work at the Bureau. So I guess I can't be too confident after 4 years, but some reason for optimism that we reached enough of a mass?
I am a 13-year WFO wife of an agent. I'll never forget when you came on as director, because all of a sudden he started printing out emails of the messages that you would send out, so you made a huge effect on him.
Those were all unclassified, by the way. Not that I'm sensitive, but those were all...
What is a message I can take back to him, because he was very hurt when you were fired? What is something that I can take back to my husband and his colleagues from you?
That we are going to be okay. That the values of that organization and this country are too deep, too wide for any leader or even group of leaders to screw up in the time that they have. Someone would have to be president of the United States for 25 years to damage that culture in an irreversible way. So we're going to be okay. Just focus on the work and remember you're doing work with moral content. And as tough as things get, that's a special opportunity. And I miss it deeply, which is why I'm going to teach next, because that to me is close. And just take nourishment from that. And no, we're going to be okay.
I want first simply to thank both you and Ben for a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
My question goes to your description of the FBI as so apolitical an organization, and you took great pride when you spoke about that. So I want to go back to 2016 and cite two things. One, your own role in 2016, which was described by many as highly political in its impact. And the second, the part of the FBI in New York that was described very extensively as being highly political, to the point where you yourself were described as being concerned about that, that it was not adequately apolitical. What's your comment?
Yeah, great questions. The first is, I'm not going to take you through, unless you want me to, but I'm not going to take all the time to go through the decision-making in the 2016 election. If you get the chance, the book isn't about this, but I lay out my thinking and try to cross-examine myself in the book. I hope you will walk away understanding that those decisions were all made to avoid political judgments, were made to protect the institutions of justice, and you had to choose between a choice that sucked and a choice that really sucked. And in every turn, we chose the least bad option and hated where we were, hated it. And when I said I was mildly nauseous, which I'm told I should have said nauseated, about the notion that the FBI had an impact on the election, the reason that makes me sick to my stomach is we desperately, desperately didn't want to have an impact on the election and didn't want to be involved at all. And if you read the book, I think you'll walk away, and you can disagree with my decisions, reasonable people certainly should, but you can't fairly say we were acting in a political way. Second, there's no doubt, I believe very, very, very firmly what I said about the culture of the FBI. In a group of 37 or 38,000, you're going to have people who may depart from those norms and those values. My concern about New York was leaks. Are people taking information that's protected information from the Bureau and taking it outside the Bureau for whatever motivation, including a political motivation? And I wanted to find out what that was so that we could enforce the norm by holding people accountable. And so none of those exceptions, to my mind, are concerning, but in fact, at least to my thinking, prove the rule that if someone did that or someone rooted for a particular candidate, they can in their private lives, but then took action to root for that candidate, that's a violation of a core value of the FBI, and people will be held severely accountable for that. So that's my reaction to that.
Hi, I'm James as well. So my original plan was to gather a couple of questions from family members, because you had mentioned that with every attack on the institution, it's taking these fringe groups in our societies and making them think that the FBI is politicized. Unfortunately, my parents are huge Trump supporters, so they had nothing nice to say. So, but having to deal with that similar thing when every time I go home, I'm hit with, you know, I work for a news organization, so I'm hit with, like, what's going on? Why did he do this? Why did he do that? What do you think we as just average citizens that are aware can do to, you know, perhaps convince these individuals that, no, it's they're not evading the law in order just to get Trump. They're doing their jobs.
The first is not to become numb or exhausted and to Like, I had this happen. I was at a cocktail party last week, and a guy comes up to me, a corporate executive, and just starts wailing on me. And he, not physically, but he's wailing on me with talking points from Fox News. And I had this moment like, I don't really feel like engaging this dude. And then I thought, you know what? He's smart. He's the CEO of a company. Maybe if I engage him, it'll echo through whatever chamber he's in. So I said, all right, look, you're wrong. Your facts are wrong. Let me take you through it. That's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. We went through Hillary Clinton and the nature of the interview. We went through all these talking points. And I said, look, I hope now that you and I have talked about it and you've heard the actual facts that you'll step back. Because surely you don't make decisions in your business relying upon someone who you've just found out gave you bad information over and over again. And so to my mind, it was a lesson to me. We can't get exhausted, one. And two, always try and reframe the conversation at the higher level. There's a lot of pain in this country, and I get the pain of the opioid crisis and globalization, all those kinds of things, really important stuff. But I constantly say to people, let's start with what we have in common. You come from a military family. A lot of people support Trump, come from families with great military stories. And so I say, what did they fight and die for? Did they fight and die for immigration, tax cut, regulatory rollback? No, they didn't. They fought and died for the rule of law, equal protection of the law, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. They fought and died for this set of values, which is all we are. I hope, and I say to these folks, is you can rise up, we'll get back to fighting about all this, rise above that and realize that we can't lose this. And the question I always put to them is, tell me what your reaction would be if the next president is a Democrat and does this, this, and this. And then the conversation gets awkward at that point. But I really think it's important that we not hate, that we try and reframe the conversation at a higher level where we have things in common, and that those of us who love this country so much don't get exhausted and don't get numb to it.
And what was the CEO's reaction when you walked him through that?
I couldn't really tell. He was grumpy. He kept shifting to other things, and I kept hitting them, hitting them, hitting them. We then sat down for a dinner, and he was more civil, I think. And I don't know whether that was the wine, so I don't want to say I turned the guy around.
This is the future of the country, like, yeah. Grumpy and then a little bit more civil. I mean, sir.
A question, historical. A person that also found himself in a difficult position at the FBI. And I'd just like to know what your thoughts are on his actions. Mark Felt. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I know the facts well enough to offer a thoughtful view on Mr. Felt. And the only reason I hesitate is because I don't know to what extent, whether there was a mix of motivations and to what extent one motivation dominated over another. I'd like to believe it was all about the country, but I've read enough and seen enough in popular film to think there might be other motivations, personal resentment, but I don't have an informed enough view to give you to make stuff up. So I won't.
Sir.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your service, sir, and your willingness to speak truth to power. Thank you very much for that. I read a story in the Post just yesterday that disturbed me greatly, and it had to do with a sign that was posted in Southern Maryland. And I'm kind of paraphrasing what it said, but it said something to the effect that liberals, if you try to or want to impeach Mr. Trump, you better get your guns. Really struck me to the core because, and I'm asking you from your perch, are we that broken as a nation that somebody would feel the right to put up a sign like that, number one? But number two, probably even more important, is the FBI onto this stuff? Are they tracking this kind of stuff? I'm fearful of a civil war in this country. I'm really fearful.
Yeah. So I'm not, but you have reason to be concerned about individual actors. I think what's happened to our national bell curve, so think big bell curve and then wing nuts at the ends. The curve has flattened in a way. The nuts are farther apart and nuttier than before. And that drags the entire curve a little bit out. I still believe I'm not worried about civil war in this country because of the sleeping giant. The sleeping giant is that. All the people who are just not reading the Post, who are raising kids, who are the great, I use the term ballast, or the ballast of this country. We've been that way since the country was founded. and occasionally have to be wakened to realize what they care about. So I'm not worried about civil war. I am worried about nuts at the wings. I guess that's why they're wing nuts. And the FBI is very, very focused on not political speech, but people who would act on political violence or exhortations to violence. Half the FBI is international terrorism and its counterterrorism division. The other half is domestic terrorism, and with also the criminal division focused on civil rights crimes. And so be assured there's a lot of work that goes on focused on that. Again, not speech, because we don't want anything to do with trying to chill speech, but when speech crosses a line into people taking action, violent action, to follow up on their beliefs, that's when the FBI gets involved.
Hi, my name is Adrian. You mentioned that you have a favorite tweet which runs something to the effect of, that Comey is such a partisan hack, I can't figure out for which party. Certainly you've had vitriol directed at you from both sides of the political spectrum. Do you view the source of that vitriol as equally legitimate for each party and equally rooted in reality?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say the criticism, I've actually never thought to sort this out, so I probably shouldn't do it on the fly, but I will. I'd say there's more factual problems with the vitriol coming from the Fox News bubble than the whatever you want to call it, the Huffington Post bubble or the MSNBC bubble. But what's so depressing about it is one bubble thinks I'm in the pocket of the other bubble, this bubble thinks I'm in the pocket of that bubble. You can't both be right, when the truth is we're not on anybody's side. But I'd say there's more factual problems with the critique coming out of Fox News commentators about how we did the Hillary Clinton investigation, that sort of thing, because so much of that is just dead wrong and they're making stuff up. So I'd say they're probably worse factually. The challenge from the left and the criticism of the Clinton investigation and whether we should have spoken about the Russia investigation, all of that is, to my mind, based on just not having a full understanding of the facts. It's not the case of having false information. One of the challenges of the whole Clinton investigation was no chance to explain, look, here's why we're doing what we're doing. And I get why people then would be confused and not understand.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Evan. I had a question about the norm of new administrations looking forwards and not backwards, and how you weigh the value of keeping that norm that the Obama administration set, and you know, largely this administration, despite all the rhetoric, you know, has just tried to undo the Obama administration, not prosecute it, and how you feel about that versus, you know, the new next president has to restore some norms and what, you know, and how you weigh those things.
Yeah, that's not easy, because if there's criminal misconduct in an agency of the government, that you shouldn't automatically then close it off simply because of a new administration. And so that's a hard call at the highest policy level for the president to make, as President Obama did. Whether you agree or disagree, I think he made a thoughtful decision about not pursuing criminal investigations with respect to interrogation, although then they kind of reversed that and did reopen criminal investigations of people who are involved. So I don't think there's an easy way to, I couldn't give you a rule in the abstract, but I certainly wouldn't want a clear line that says anything that happened in a prior administration we don't pursue, because, I don't know, there'll be bank robberies in one administration, or embezzlement or bribery, even at a lower level in administrations. And so I wouldn't ever want to rule it out. I'd want to make a thoughtful decision about it.
So let's say it's early 2021 and the next administration comes to you and says, how can we rebuild trust in the IC and in the FBI? What advice would you give them to help the rank and file of not just the FBI, but across the IC believe that once again the White House and House Intelligence has their back?
Quality leadership and a leaning forward on transparency. That is, from the president down, talking the talk and walking the walk of showing people how we do what we do and why. And the IC's gotten better at this. The Bureau's gotten better at this. Well, did get better at this in the Obama administration about offering transparency. So that's what I would do. Quality leadership that gets out there and talks about the work, shows the work as often as possible. And that's how you slowly rebuild trust.
Hi, sir. I'm Lauren. Last week, I was at an event about hate speech in elections in Nigeria, of all places. And one of the people in the audience mentioned that they need civil society has to have ethical leadership in responding to this. And as I was walking back to work, I was thinking about your book and realized that no one in the audience had really touched upon how, as an individual, we can display ethical leadership. So I was just wondering if you could go into, at an individual level, how we can take steps to display personal integrity and leadership on a daily basis and also encourage people around us to do so, whether it be our management or family and friends. Thank you.
Yeah. Most important way to is to model the elements of ethical behavior. First of all, whether you're leading somebody or not, again, it doesn't matter what you say, but how you act. And so there's lots of different ways to model it that your parents would hope for and that you would hope for your children. And then as a leader, it's to model it and also try to offer transparency as part of that modeling to those you lead about how you make decisions. Because to my mind, ethical leadership, ethical decision making isn't about the result, it's about the process. What are the reference points you look to in making a decision? Now, to my mind, ethical leaders look to things like law, tradition, philosophy, sometimes religious precepts. There are external reference points that help them make decisions. And one of my real concerns about our president is he doesn't have any external reference points. And that's really concerning to me. The only reference point is internal. But an ethical leader has external reference points and shows the work to the people around them so that they see, ah, that's how it's done. One. Two, an ethical leader creates an environment where the truth is at the center, especially the truth about themselves from their people. And so creating an environment where people are encouraged, protected, almost begged to tell the truth, knowing that they won't be hurt for telling the truth, is at the core of being a good leader. And that's the kind of leadership I call ethical leadership, to have that ethical value at the center of it.
Thank you. So I'm curious, you've talked about the diversity initiatives and the cultural changes and your 10-year vision for the institution. And so I'm curious what else was in that 10-year vision, either structurally in terms of building the agency's capacity or substantive focus, what else you wanted to do with your remaining 6 years?
A few things. I won't tick them all off, but top of mind, approach to diversity, closely related approach to leadership. My goal was to turn the FBI into the U.S. government's leadership factory. I see you're wearing a uniform. And that I said, you know what? The private sector in America often looks to the military services for leaders. That ought to be us. And that we ought to be a leadership factory in the FBI. So there's a lot about that transformation. But one of the legacies of the Hoover era was leadership was something you avoided, and sometimes you got volunteered into leadership, and that's a recipe for wildly inconsistent quality of leadership, and that was our situation. So that continued to drive the intelligence transformation. We talked about how hard it is to change culture. Bob Mueller pushed on that for 7 years. It needed my full 10 years to drive the integration between operations and intelligence. There are lots of things we did to try and drive that. Again, culture being so hard to change, one of the most important was have the analysts and the agents sit together, drive in the cars together, go out to lunch together, because it's hard to hate up close, and come to know each other. So that was a big part of it. And then I'll spare you the rest, but cyber was a big part of it. I was trying to reorganize the FBI and reorient it as to focus on cyber. And then there's a few others, but I'll stop there.
Hello, my name is Daniel Schmidt. Thanks very much, Director. A question about the midterms. Mike Pence has said the other day it's time to wrap up for the special counsel and his investigation. Seems a bit premature. However, what do you do to avoid the same thing in November as in November 2016, to be called out and made responsible for any kind of going this way or that way?
Yeah. Yeah, I see all the time, having done a lot of investigations, it's just a feature of every investigator's life in a prominent case that people who have no idea what's going on in the investigation have strong feelings about how it should be going. And so you just can't pay attention to comments from people who aren't in the investigation. And the great thing about Director Mueller's operation is they're not giving any comments out to anybody, so no one knows, except we have high-quality people who are doing it. Bob Mueller is, like I, a creature of the culture of the Department of Justice. Despite what you've read, there actually aren't any rules about how you should conduct yourself in the run-up to an election. There's a 2012 Eric Holder memo about how to conduct investigations of election crimes, and I keep seeing reporters hyperlink to that, saying Comey violated rules. Please read the memo. But there are no rules, but there's an important norm. If you can avoid it, you take no action in the run-up to an election that could have any impact. The problem we faced in the Clinton email investigation was, thanks to Anthony Weiner's computer, I couldn't find the no take no action option. But I would expect that Director Mueller, as a creature of that culture, would be attuned to that norm and that tradition. I don't know which way that cuts, but I have confidence that he would think about it in whatever decisions he makes, as would I in his position.
You've spoken numerous times this afternoon to this sleeping giant analogy. And you've also praised the press for maintaining their rigor and their investigative journalism to highlight and not stay numb while trusted institutions continues to erode. I think some would say that it's possibly in the nature of the press in general to simply chase what is sensational. And we do have a president now that, intentional or not, is providing fodder for that. For those who I guess qualify for this sleeping giant, my question to you is, you know, what is this tipping point for this outside of D.C., this kind of middle America, the tipping point to either have their opinions changed or to become active? Because to me, if they're fatigued in this bombardment of news of the cycle, we're a year and a half into this presidency. So if not now, then when?
Yeah, I don't know what the tipping point is. And a pessimist might say the giant will stay sleeping because it's an anesthetic is being sprayed over the top of the giant, this numbing. But I think important parts of the tipping point are you see some reflected in the polls about how Americans feel. We hear from the vocal base, but 60-some percent of Americans have serious concerns about the president's trustworthiness. I think that Charlottesville, although we have forgotten it in a lot of ways, remains very important in this culture because I've read a lot of Jonathan Haidt's work. I don't know if people know his work, but he's a social psychologist who talks about the power of taboo in all cultures, especially our culture. The president touched a taboo there, and that's not gone away yet. And I could see that. He talks about all the ways that someone has to atone once they touch a taboo, and to proclaim moral equivalence across Charlottesville is something that has not been atoned in this culture. And so I would expect things like that. And when the busy American people start to focus on an election again, I'm not sure it'd be a tipping point, but I would see the giant being roused. I'm more optimistic about the giant being roused the closer we get, not to the 2018 election, but the 2020 election. When they realize, after another 3 years of attacks on the rule of law and the norms that we care about, that we just, even if you have passion about the policy, this is not who we are. We need a different leader. And I would hope, and this is what I worry about with I talked about those tales, that, forget about independence in this country, although a lot of us are independents, that the Democratic Party picks someone who reflects the values of this country in a way that is comforting to that sleeping giant. And instead, we don't run to a place where we have the two most unpopular and least trusted people in the history of polling running against each other. And so a lot of that, I think the waking becomes much more likely the closer we get to that event. That's not a great answer, but that's my best answer.
So I'm going to take the last question myself. You've done a lot of interviews. You've talked about the book a lot. You've been asked about a lot of aspects of the book. What's the aspect of the book that you expected to be asked about that everyone's ignored? What's the question that you have been waiting for somebody to ask you and haven't gotten?
That's what I used to ask people at the end of criminal interviews. So what were you? were you afraid I was going to ask you? The question, it all focused first on the stuff that people didn't even have to read the book to ask about. It's really not a Trump book. He's an important feature of it because I can't write about ethical leadership and tell stories about ethical leadership without offering the counterpoint. But and I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. That's just what I believe. And And so I was not asked about, look, there's some really interesting stuff in there about torture and about the struggle over stellar wind and Bob Mueller's role in that. I recount in the book one of the moments that I will never forget, Bob Mueller leaning down over the nearly unconscious attorney general after we fended off the two people trying to get him to sign off on the program in his hospital room. And Bob Mueller said, there comes a time in every man's life when the good Lord tests him. You passed your test tonight. When I heard those words, I almost started crying in that room. And to me, that's a remarkable moment of insight, too, about the character and quality of the person who's now the special prosecutor. Literally no one has asked me about that. And which tells me they didn't read the book. Right? Because a reporter read the book, they'd say, wow, he's got this cool story about Bob Mueller and John Ashcroft. Now I just gave it away. That's all off the record.
Please join me in thanking Jim for being here. So for the podcast listening audience, there's a few things I've got to say, which is that the Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. I want to thank everybody, you know, at Brookings who did a lot of work to make this event happen. If you've never listened to the Lawfare podcast before, and I know that's not anybody in this room, but it's maybe lots of people who are listening to it for the first time because, you know, Jim Comey's on it. You might want to subscribe to it. Our music is performed by Lawfare's official pianist, Sophia Yan. And even if you don't subscribe to the Lawfare podcast, you will certainly want to tweet about it, share it on Facebook, and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast distribution service you may use. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.